Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of the series universe. My name is Arimithius, and today I'm discussing a figure who has divided the gods and the mortals, who either cursed everyone to dirt or gave them the gift of existence. Today we're asking, who is Lorcan? Before we kick off, though, I'd just like to give my thanks to Tanner Huggins and Peter, who have become my very first patrons. Thank you ever so much that you've chosen to support me. I hope that you've been enjoying the early access and the notes. If you want to become my patron and get more Written in Uncertainty information and early access to everything, please head over to patreon.com/writteninuncertainty. Or if you'd like to give me a quick tip, I also have an account with Ko-fi, so head over to Ko-fi/Arimithius. That's ko-fi.com/Arimithius and drop a tip in the jar. I also want to say, as usual, that this is my own understanding of Lorcan and not the whole truth of who he is. I would absolutely love to hear your own ideas on this. Please leave a comment wherever you're listening or in the blog post at writteninuncertainty.wordpress.com. I'll also be listing all the sources that I quote in this cast in the blog post, so please check them out and come to your own conclusions about who Lorcan is and what he's up to. Lorcan is the Etarda who is either credited or blamed, depending on who you ask, for the creation of the mortal plane, and got his heart ripped out by the Aedra for his trouble. He's called the God of Mortals in several places, and the Space God in Etarda Ate Aedra Eat the Dreamer. We'll get to precisely what that means a little later, but it's an association that's worth bearing in mind when thinking about Lorcan overall, I think. And also, while Lorcan is the god most associated with mortality and the mortal plane, he isn't actually responsible for much of its actual shape. Lorcan was the mastermind of the project, but the Aedra as a whole determined its shape and its laws. It can, however, be argued that Lorcan did sacrifice the most for the mortal plane, given that most myths say that he got his heart ripped out. And as well as being the space god, Lorcan is also associated with the moons in a lot of places, mostly thanks to the book The Lunar Lorcan. To quote, "In short, the moons were and are the two halves of Lorcan's flesh divinity. Like the rest of the gods, Lorcan was a planet that participated in the great construction. Except where the eight lent portions of their heavenly bodies to create the mortal planet, Lorcan's was cracked asunder and his divine spark fell to Nern as a shooting star to impregnate it with the measure of its existence and a reasonable amount of selfishness." Other myths consider that Lorcan's heart was torn out either by Akatosh or Trinimac, depending on who you ask, which is the divine spark we just heard about. This is also where the idea of the moons being Lorcan's corpse come from. However, I don't think it's quite the whole story. For one thing, the Khajiit, who are intimately connected with the moons, don't associate Lorcaj with Joan and Jode, but rather a third moon that other faiths don't acknowledge actually exists. This would put it as something like the appearance of duality hiding a unity, which is the underlying reality. Remember that, it will come up again later. Following his death, in inverted commas, at the hands of the Aedra, Lorcan has also been called the Missing God, which has more in this world to do with a retcon that was applied in Morrowind than anything else. The way that the gods were presented previously were, as put in the Selective's Lorecast episode on Lorcan, a copy-paste Eight Divines. Michael Kirkbride remarked that he introduced Lorcan during the redevelopment of much of the lore after Daggerfall in order to make the pantheons more distinct from each other, that they have a god to disagree about rather than having a large collection of beings that are largely agreed upon in their aspects makes the Mannish and Mirish cultures much more individual and, in my opinion, makes the lore much more interesting in how the gods are presented. That multifaceted perspective is key to understanding Lorcan too. as much as most fans use the Lorcan myth as the core, there's also Lorcaj, Shazar, Shor, Shior, and Sep. I'm probably missing some somewhere. However, unlike the Time God, unlike Akatosh and Auriel and Alduin, the different aspects of Lorcan are not really in conflict. When you look at Akatosh and Alduin, they are quite opposed in the plot of The Elder Scrolls V, but Shor, Lorcan and the rest all share the same, or at least quite similar goals. As such, I'll be treating Lorcan, Shor, Shazar and the rest as the same entity, in a way that you can't really say for Akatosh and his aspects. And those facets may actually be better described as shards that have been shattered and spread throughout Tamriel, which also has some other implications, which we'll get to. The term for those shards is the Shezarines, generally, if you look at various parts of the fandom. They're seen as avatars of Lorcan moving throughout Tamriel's history. These have been expressed most clearly in the Khajiiti creation myth, even if they aren't explicitly named that way. Instead, we have this quote. "The children of Fadamai tore out the heart of Lorcaj and hid it deep within Nirni, and they said, 'We curse you, noisy Lorcaj, to walk Nirni for many phases.'" Those individuals who walk Nirn as Lorcan are the Shezarines. This is expressed in similar terms in Before the Ages of Man, in my opinion. We have this quote. "Also, during the late Merithic era, the legendary hero, warrior, sorcerer, and king, variously known as Pelennor Whitestrake, Harald Hairybreeks, Ysmir, Hans the Fox, etc., wandered Tamriel, gathering armies, conquering lands, ruling, then abandoning his kingdoms to wander again." This indicates that Lorcan is essentially engaging in futile endeavours, things that will not last. He goes around wars, establishes something, and then it falls to bits. I think this is quite fitting for how the elves see Lorcan in particular. Of the characters named above, by the way, Pelennor Whitestrake and Ysmir are the only named ones that we know of in any real detail, although Hans the Fox is named among Iskramor's 500 companions. Pelennor Whitestrake is probably the best known for being a Shezarine. He's actually referred to as possibly the Shezarine in the Song of Pelennor, and although we don't quite get a handle of what that means, the people who suggested it get smothered by moths very quickly afterwards, suggesting that there's something going on there. I think it's also possible that all of the names that we heard in Before the Ages of Man are actually the same being, that Pelennor is Ysmir, who is Hans the Fox, and so on and so forth, which again points to a unity within the Shezarines and Lorcan's manifestations in general. And as much as these heroes, or maybe just one hero, are seen to be Shezarines, there aren't that many precise meanings of what the Shezarine actually is. The word implies a reincarnation of Shazar, which would mean a reincarnation of Lorcan. However, it feels a bit more complicated than that, as each of the people named definitely had their own identity, as well as potentially being an aspect of Lorcan. Clearly, the being of Lorcan is not manifest directly in the Shezarines, I don't think. They are distinct from Shazar himself. The only thing that they really have in common is that they don't hang around. They go missing after founding their empires or doing whatever they came to do, which does entirely fit with Lorcan as the missing god. To complicate things a little further, there was a post made by Michael Kirkbride in 2004 that listed Lorcan's avatars as the various aspects of Hjalti Earlybeard, Ysmir Wolfarth, and Zurin Arctus, and other parts of that enantiomorph, and they appear under several different names, but essentially being the same thing. I mean, Talos and Septim are listed as separate beings in that list, for example. that's going into how I think MK wanted to originally formulate that particular enantiomorph, but I don't really want to get into that right now. The thing here is that that list is taken by several fans to be a list of Chezzarines, if not the list of Chezzarines. I'm a little skeptical here, as the list doesn't include Pelennil, which I think should be obvious as far as Chezzarines go. But that's just my opinion. That's contested even within the books that we have. And as a result, we don't really have any concrete answers as to precisely who is a Chezzarine and who isn't. In fact, there's a relatively common theory that you'll see around that the last Dragonborn is a Chezzarine. This is mostly taken from the apparent absence of Shaw from Sovngarde when the last Dragonborn goes to visit, and the way that the player character can sit on Shaw's throne. However, if you ask around in Sovngarde, you'll get the line that Shaw's high throne stands empty, his mien is too bright for mortal eyes. That means that he's possibly still there, just not on his throne. So it's not really like the last Dragonborn is replacing him or representing him, as is the kind of unspoken assumption in this particular theory. If the last Dragonborn is appearing in Sovngarde and Shaw isn't there, and the last Dragonborn can suddenly do all these things that you'd expect Shaw to do, then the theory goes the last Dragonborn is Shaw, is a Chezzarine. However, I think that's a little too vague and tenuous for my tastes, because you don't get beings like Stun recognizing you for what you are in that case. You don't get recognized as a representative of Shaw when you confront him at the Whalebone Bridge, but as Dragonborn. I have also heard it said that because Ysmir is in MK's list of Chezzarines, that means that the last Dragonborn is a Chezzarine because they get called Ysmir by the Greybeards during the initiation ceremony in High Hrothgar. However, I think that given when the list was written and the other people in the list, that particular Ysmir can only really apply to Ysmir Wulfarth. Ysmir as the Dragon of the North is a title that's given out. It's not something that says anything about a being's inherent nature. So I take that to mean that only one particular Ysmir is included in the list of Chezzarines, given that pretty much all of the other names in the list are to do with the Hjalti Zurin Wulfarth enantiomorph, rather than anyone who's taken the title Ysmir throughout history. Lorcan has, at least in his Mirish view, a clear inspiration in the Demiurge, a being that is present in quite a few strands of real-world theology, and is generally seen as a limited or flawed creator who makes a world that's imperfect. This is kind of hinted at in the Monomyth, where Lorcan gets referred to as a barely formed urge, a half-urge, a demi-urge, maybe? But within the Greek pre-Gnostic systems of thought that involve the demiurge is a second cause, a being that comes after the first mover, which again fits Lorcan because Akatosh made time possible first. Another thing that's an import from other strands of Gnosticism is that the notion that the Demiurge does not create out of nothing, he merely shapes stuff. Lorcan, in the conventional telling, cannot make Mundus on his own and needs the Aedra to help him do it. He's shaping stuff that's already there in that sense. He's manipulating the other gods and not making stuff out of thin air. Several forms of Gnosticism, although not all, do have a moral judgment on the Demiurge, and that the creation is messed up and bad, that the material world is inherently sinful, because the Demiurge has made the material world and drawn spirits away from their true pursuits. the one that I particularly know about in this respect is Catharism, which advocates as little involvement with the material world as possible, because the material world is sin itself. That manifests as asceticism, vegetarianism, and various other things as well, and celibacy as among other things. None of the Elder Scrolls faiths go that far in denying the material world, but several Moorish faiths do have a similar attitude to Lorcan. But in particular, remember the first volume of The Truth and Sequence calls Lorcan a deceiver. It's expressed like this: "Our lessers knew the source as two forms, Anu and Padme, but this binary is without merit. One of the Lorcan's great lies, meant to sunder us from the truth of a Nuic unity." And remember that claim, by the way, it will be important later. For now, though, I want to take that sundering and division as an important part of Lorcan's character. There's a line from the Lunar Lorcan that says that railing against a dichotomy and division is part of who Lorcan is, but that's not quite in line with how he's seen elsewhere. He's noted in a few places as the son of Sithis, or the soul of Sithis, which in Gnostic terms is more or less the same thing. Souls emanate from greater beings, and so are created from greater beings, in the same way that we see the beings like Anu'iel coming from Anu, and Auriel coming from Anu'iel within the Elder Scrolls. Sithis is a being of limit, of not being, and Lorcan created a place that was mortal, that was almost entirely limit. That he wound up being the most dead of the Aedra in the process is, I think, slightly ironic, unless that was his plan all along. There's an awful lot about the general creation story of Mundus that frankly feels rather convenient. Magnus leaving and creating the sun, bringing light and magic, is an incredible piece of coincidence, if that's what it was. That kind of thing makes me think that Lorcan would have at least planned for something like Magnus's exodus to have occurred, and possibly even his own semi-death as part of the process. In particular, we have this line from Varieties of Faith: "After the world is materialized, Lorcan is separated from his divine center, sometimes involuntarily, and wanders the creation of the Etada." The wandering is another allusion to the Shezarin, but the bit that intrigues me here is that it's only sometimes involuntary. That means, somewhere, that there are myths that tell how Lorcan tore out his own heart. I imagine that it's in a similar way to how Trinimac is described as tearing the shame from his spirit in Moloch Orcfather, by the way. Now, why would anyone do that? Why mutilate yourself in that way to create the world? I think the Ultmeri creation myth has a possible answer here when it gives the heart of Lorcan its own words. The quote is this: "But when Trinimac and Auriel tried to destroy the heart of Lorcan, it laughed at them. It said, 'This heart is the heart of the world, for one was made to satisfy the other.'" So the world was made to satisfy Lorcan's heart. He desired the world in some way, really wanted it. I think that we possibly have enough myths to indicate that Lorcan was aiming to make something that was reflective of him. In particular, the Ultmeri myth also says that he was more of a limit than a nature, so he could never last anywhere. And the Yokuden myth says that Sep had much of the hungry stomach left in him. Both of those indicate that mortality and limit are fundamentally a part of Lorcan, and so Mundus was made to reflect that. So why make a place that's full of limits? Surely living forever and carrying on and doing whatever the hell you like is a good thing, yes? I think that Lorcan made a place full of limits to allow entities to go beyond them. If you have no limits, you can't transcend them. You need to delineate in order to know anything. That's why we have Vivek calling Sithis the start of all true houses in the 36 lessons, because to say we are X means that some things will be not X. It's also why Anu and Sithis create souls to distinguish between things, which is an inherently limiting and limited activity. Just to briefly diverge for a second here into real-world philosophy, this is also reflective of how Immanuel Kant saw the world. He proposed a thing called transcendental idealism in how people thought about and constructed the world. The very way of being in a world imposed limits on things through people's minds. The sensory experience that people have is what Kant called the manifold of intuition. It's just stuff. You are being bombarded with absolutely everything by your senses. And in order to tell anything apart at all, your mind has to do some sorting. It has to put the forms of intuition in place, to use Kant's terms, which are space and time itself. This has the bizarre consequence that space and time aren't actually objective realities, but just things that people's minds impose on reality to try and order things. But it's the same thing that's going on here. It's the idea that having to distinguish some things means that you have to start sorting, categorizing, limiting in order to understand what's going on. And so from this perspective, a being that is everything, like Anu is in several tellings of the monomyth, is both everything and nothing at the same time. Nothing can be done by such a being because you've got no comparison on which to base any action whatsoever. Thinking back to the example of Kant and the manifold of intuition, if you can't tell one object apart from another, or even that there are objects at all, you can do nothing. You could just flail, and you don't even know what you're flailing about, or even that it's you flailing. You need to be able to have those distinctions between me, not me, thing A, thing B, etc., in order to take any action at all. Those sorts of distinctions will be important when we come to look at souls in the Elder Scrolls universe, but I think we should probably get back to Lorcan before I get entirely overtaken by tangents at this point. So, how or why do we think that Lorcan wanted others to go beyond their limits? That's something that's openly pondered by Devaith Fear in the Inexplicable Patron Questions in the Loremasters Archive. In particular, we have this quote. "Consider, ebony is a substance whose acquisition and use tempts mortals into acts of achievement that transcend their usual limitations. Did Lorcan intend this?" Fear doesn't actually give us an answer, but I think the answer would be yes. The book The Anticipations puts Boethia's role as the one who told the Chimer the truth of Lorcan's test, to quote, which is also connected to the Psijic Endeavour, which is potentially a way to achieve Chim. A quick side note here, we possibly also get Boethia fangirling about Lorcan quite heavily in Sermon 10 of the 36 Lessons, which is linked to the triangled truth, in my opinion. In particular, we have this quote attributed to Boethia by Vivek. "We pledge ourselves to you, the frame maker, the scarab, a world for us to love you in, a cloak of dirt to cherish, betrayed by your ancestors when you were not even looking." The cloak of dirt is typically taken to be Mundus itself, as well as drawing parallels with Lorcan getting his heart torn out. However, there are a few potential problems with this that I think I should bring up. On the face of it, it's not clear why the other Etarda who punished Lorcan are necessarily his ancestors as such. It's possible that being barely formed could mean that Lorcan is younger, perhaps, but that's the only hint that we have that could be true. The frame is also possibly not Mundus, as Vivek uses an ebony listening frame elsewhere in 36 Lessons to drive off Ysmir. So while the explanation of Lorcan being the Scarab here is tempting, I can't say for sure that it's the right one. If you want to dig more into this and why the Scarab might not be Lorcan, the Reddit user Maztiak has produced a fantastic little piece of analysis on the TES Lore subreddit, which is well worth a read. I'll be posting a link to that in the blog post alongside this cast, so check it out there if you want to look a bit more into it. There's also the quite frequent question as to whether Lorcan is an Aedra or a Daedra. On the face of it, with the definition of Aedra being those Etada who created Mundus and the Daedra as the ones who didn't, then Lorcan couldn't be more Aedric. He gave his whole life to Mundus in a way that the others didn't, really. However, there are a few things that contradict this, as ever. The book Sithis says this: "Soon, it seemed that Lorcan had a dominion of his own, with slaves and everlasting imperfections, and he seemed, for all the world, like an Aedra." So he seemed like an Aedra, not that he was one. There's also the slightly pedantic point that Aedra, in the Mur-ish usage, means our ancestors, and no Mur is going to claim descent from Lorcan. So he's not a Mur-ish Aedra, but then we have it in the monomyth that the humans appropriate the term to mean the ones that make Mundus, and so the strict definition argument in terms of what Aedra means might not quite cut it, depending on who you talk to. We also have the little matter of Mankar Cameron, who claims that Mundus is Lorcan's personal plane of oblivion, and not a creation that was made from the Aedra. If that's the case, then Lorcan is definitely a Daedra. Quite what that makes the other Aedra is another question, but the general way I've seen of thinking about it, in the way that Cameron talks about it, in terms of the other Aedra being servants and so on, is that they are lesser Daedra who rebelled against Lorcan. That this is possible has some really interesting implications for the nature of Oblivion, as well as Mundus, but we'll have to leave that one until another cast. And now I want to go back to Chim, because things always go back to Chim in the end when you're talking about the Elder Scrolls metaphysics, it seems. The central realization of Chim, that the world and the individual are the same thing, is something that Lorcan realized if we follow Vex's teaching, particularly this passage. "Anu's firstborn, for he mostly desired order, was Time Anon Akatosh. Padhome's firstborn went wandering from the start, changing as he went, and wanted no name, but was branded with Lorcan. As time allowed more and more patterns to individualise, Lorcan watched the Arabis shape itself and grew equally delighted and tired with each new shaping. As the gods and demons of the Arabis erupted, the Get of Padhome tried to leave it all behind, for he wanted all of it and none of it all at once. It was then that he came to the border of the Arabis. He saw the tower, for a circle turned sideways as an eye. This was the first word of Lorcan, and he would never, ever forget it." Now, this passage shows us similar behaviours to the Shezarines and the Khajiiti punishment of Lorcan, the constant wandering, but casts it as a good thing. But the main thing that I wanted to draw out here was the eye. The eye is the expression of the tower, the core realization of Chim. You realize that I is the universe, and as a result, through wordplay and such, you are the universe as well. This is explicitly referenced later in that passage of Vex's teaching with this endnote: "The world that you stand on is said to be the first attempt at Chim. It is also admittedly the most famous. That it was choreographed by Lorcan and ultimately failed is well documented, but whether or not this failure was intentional is still disputed. Wait, why would anyone want to purposefully fail the process of Chim? And this is the most reached destination of all that embark upon this road. Why would Lokan and his unwitting agents sabotage their experiments with the tower? Why would he crumble all that which he esteems? Perhaps he failed so that you might know how not to. So this casts Lokan as someone who is imposing limits on others and giving them an opportunity to move beyond current modes of existence. He's choosing not to do it himself, but to give others the opportunity. It's not entirely clear here whether it was intended to be the ultimate moving beyond that is the Amaranth, but I think it's a pretty safe assumption. Lokan highlighted the fundamental boundary that is the Arabis so that people might move beyond it. This also potentially fits with the scarab metaphor, as dung beetles, scarabs, lay eggs in dung that then hatch and fly away from the dung ball. If Lokan is the scarab, he's making a place that others can escape from. And now I wanted to talk about Lokan and Akatosh for a bit. These two deities are often portrayed as opposites, one coming from Auriel and the other from Sithis. However, there are a few hints here and there that they're not quite as distinct as they appear. I think this is at its most obvious in The Elder Scrolls IV and Oblivion, when statues and pictures of Akatosh have both the head of a dragon and a man. There are others, less obvious things in the games that point to similar things. Remember earlier when I talked about the great lies meant to sunder us from the truth of a Nuic unity, from the truth in sequence? That is, I think, hinting at the same thing. And then we also have this line from the Song of Pelennil, where Pelennil is said to have stated, "O Akka, for our shared madness I do this." And Pelennil, if he is the Shezarine, is speaking as Lokan potentially at that point, so why bring Akka into it as sharing something unless the two are linked? But perhaps the most telling one for me is that some sources, like Chim El Adabal, a ballad, claim that the Amulet of Kings is Lokan's blood, while Trials of Elysia and the book Amulet of Kings both imply heavily that it's Lokan's blood that make up the amulet. There's some severe confusion going on there about whose blood goes into the amulet. And there was actually a forum thread made in 2006 where Michael Kirkbride flat out stated that there was intended to be more ambiguity about who gave Elysia the Amulet of Kings than actually made it into the game. This and all of the other hints that we have seem to point to one thing, that Akatosh and Lokan are the same being. I'll say that again, Akatosh and Lokan are the same being. At least if you take all of these little hints and smash them together. There's quite a few others out there that it'd be a bit tedious to list off all at once, I'm afraid. If you do want to see my whole list, then sign up to become my patron and you can see all the notes that I've made for this cast as part of that. This similarity is a little clearer if we put a dollop of modern physics along with it. According to Einsteinian relativity, space and time are not distinct things. And remember that Etarda et Adra et the Dreamer refers to Akatosh as the space god. If we think about how relativity works, space and time are just separate parts of a single space-time unity, which is potentially what the ultimate truth of Mundus is, if we consider both Lokan's revelation of the tower and that he and Akatosh are mirror brothers, or in other words, just two sides of the same coin, that everything is all one thing, it's just that it's been split up and subdivided to the point where it can't remember what it is anymore. And on that particular bombshell, I think we can conclude our look at Lorcan, at least for now. He's seen as many things, as a deceiver, a creator, a warlord. He's one of the most fascinating characters within the Elder Scrolls, and I do hope you've enjoyed plumbing his depths a little bit with me. And if you like what you've heard here, please do consider subscribing and leaving a review wherever you listen. If you want to support me in a more personal way, drop me a tip at ko-fi.com/Arimathias, that's ko-fi.com/Arimathias, or become my patron at patreon.com/writteninuncertainty. Patrons get early access to all the content I put out and an exclusive look at the notes I make to prepare for these podcasts. Links to both of these will be in this cast's description, as well as the Written in Uncertainty website, where you can also see the full blog post that goes alongside this cast and find all the text that I pull from as I go through this stuff. Next time, having looked at a god who was mutilated during Mundus's creation, we're going to examine another one who was mutilated during Mundus's creation. Next time, we're asking, who is Trinimac? Until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Arimathias. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky and Jeremy Saul. You can find Jan's work on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and Jeremy's Northerner Diaries is available for purchase and on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.